Today at Radio Verulam, we're once again speaking to our local MP, Daisy Cooper, to get the answers to your questions. But remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get answers from Daisy this time, she'll be back again next month. Now, Daisy, since we last spoke, it's been a little bit of a while, and you've been on your summer recess, so I think people will be interested to know, were you able to find a bit of time for yourself during this period, and what kept you busy during that time?
Well, I had 6 days. My husband and I took 6 days off for a holiday. We went up to Scarborough. This was when it was super, super hot, and I just felt that it was, you know, it was too hot and too busy on the south coast. So 6 days in Scarborough was nice, cool, 24 degrees, and we just potted around by the beach, looking at small buildings and some castles, and having a couple of meals out and some fish and chips on the beach. It was really nice.
And with this recess time, though, we've talked to Bim FLME as well, and he's attested to the fact that it's not really a time off for MPs. So were you kept busy with constituent problems as well during this, you know, supposed holiday period for MPs?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, just because MPs aren't sitting in Westminster doesn't mean that you're not working. So the kind of things that stop are that you have a lot of campaign groups, you know, like Friends of the Earth or other groups like that, and they normally run campaigns throughout the year. Those kind of things actually stop, but lots of constituents still need your help. So whether it's their housing situation, whether it's a welfare application, whether it's a complaint about either a medical treatment or something else like that, there's still lots and lots of individual problems that we help people with during over the summer.
And let's talk about politics then, because, you know, a lot of changes this month for you personally, but also for your party. There are two new leaders, Ed Davey as party leader, and now yourself as deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats. Now, on the note of party, what did these changes mean, and why did you back Ed as the new leader?
Sure. Well, I mean, Ed's got a huge amount of experience, and I think that will really help, because we're a very new parliamentary party, and therefore I think it's really important that we use the experience that we have. He's also got a sort of, he's had this laser-like focus on the climate emergency and the crisis in social care, and these are things that I talked about during his leadership contest, but these are two of the biggest issues facing our country. You know, we've seen during the coronavirus just how much people value care workers, but care workers don't have anything like the same security or salary or support that NHS workers rightly have. So it's really important that we continue to bang the drum for carers and make sure they get a better deal.
Now, Daisy, as always with these discussions, Radio Verulam is here to help the community, and we called for questions for you. So let's move it on to what the people of the area want to know. We've had a few questions on this topic, Daisy. Andy said that he's unimpressed that the current hospital provision supports only £20 million investment in St Albans, and it's against this, £540 million is going to Watford General Hospital. He's asked, you have stated your support for the Trust's redevelopment at Watford Hospital, but in light of the massive backlash to this idea amongst your electors, do you think it's time to change or reconsider your position? That's what Andy said.
So this is a long-running issue, and there are views on both sides. I would say that those who are opposed to the three-hospital plan are probably more vocal, but there was a consultation that closed on Tuesday, so we have no idea what the numbers are in terms of what percentage of electors voted. What I would say is that I do support the idea of investing in the three-hospital structure rather than building a wholly new one, and that's for a few reasons. So the first is that clinicians themselves, the people who actually work in the hospitals, the doctors and the nurses and the consultants, they want the three-hospital solution. They said that's the best solution for them. So clinicians themselves are telling us that they want to have the three hospital solution. The second thing is that if we built an entirely brand new hospital, which, and I don't believe there's the money there to do it, but if we built an entirely brand new hospital, the St Albans Hospital would have to close down. And actually, I think it's really, really important that we keep our local hospital for elective care, because people, when they want to have an operation on their shoulder or they want to have a blood test, it's really important people can go somewhere that's close and local and convenient without having to go much further away. So there's a couple of good reasons there. I think since the coronavirus hit, we have seen the benefits of having three different hospitals, because one hospital was able to look after the COVID patients, whilst the other hospitals managed to carry on to provide non-COVID care. And I think with COVID not going away, and possibly the risk of other pandemics in future, that's another positive reason. And I guess the last thing I would say is that the government has recently changed its lending rules, which means that the government is now prepared to lend more money to our local trust. And as a result, what the trust is now thinking of doing is actually building a brand new hospital, but on the existing Watford site. So it's quite possible we might get a brand new hospital anyway, built next door to the Watford Hospital. And then once that new one is ready, they kind of shift over and then demolish the old one. And that wasn't the case before, and it was a less than perfect situation. But it now seems as though we might actually get effectively a brand new hospital anyway. And if that's the case, I can't see why people want to oppose it.
Well, there you go, Andy. Maybe that answers Andy's questions there. Now, Annie has asked us something which I think a lot of people are really worried about, and it's the Sunday Times expose that revealed the leaked figures showing the scale of this coronavirus test shortage. So she's asked, does this mean that the situation is actually much, much worse? And what is being done to correct these awful problems? Annie has said that it makes her worried to send her children back to school.
Well, I mean, nobody should panic, but it is very worrying, and I can't deny that. I need to be honest about that. It is very worrying. The government's testing system has effectively stopped, and we have a real problem in that people here in St Albans have been asked to travel as far as Aberdeen or Inverness to get a test, and in the last few days, there's been no tests available at all. So it is really, really worrying. And until we can get that testing capacity up, we simply don't know how many people have got COVID. So we don't know how many people have got it. And if we don't know how many people have got it, we don't know whether we're in the danger zone or not. So it is very worrying not to have that information. And I'm not going to deny that. On the question of whether or not she sends her children to school, what I would say is I would really, really encourage Annie or any other concerned parents to talk to the school, because every school is different. The schools are different shapes and sizes, which means they are catering to children and different bubbles and different school groups differently. Some have got more flexibility than others. Some schools will know of suspected or actual COVID cases, whereas some may not have any of those at all. So talk to the school, particularly if your child or somebody at home is vulnerable or extremely clinically vulnerable, and talk to the staff about what can be done. So don't make any rash decisions, but talk to the schools. The schools are in regular contact with the County Council's public health team. We have got one of the best public health directors in the country working here in Hertfordshire. If there is any reason why a school needs to take some form of action, then they won't delay in making that clear. So no one needs to panic, but yes, there are good reasons to be worried, and I understand that people are worried, and I'm very worried too. And I've been doing my best this week to try and challenge, to try and ask questions about this to make sure we get some answers soon.
And also, I think another thing that might appease or help people like Annie, can you offer a bit of clarity on the comments from Matt Hancock that you shouldn't have a test unless you're showing symptoms?
So the fact is that we don't have enough testing capacity to test everybody, right? So in an ideal world, you'd be providing tests for lots of people, almost everybody, all the time. We don't have that testing capacity, and therefore it has to be restricted and groups have to be prioritised. So because of the prioritisation and the need to do that, we have to follow the government advice, which now is that anybody who's displaying symptoms should request a test. But if you're not displaying symptoms, then you shouldn't. So in an ideal world, of course, you'd have a much bigger testing system. Lots of people could get tested all the time, but we don't have that. And therefore, we have to be quite restrictive and prioritise those people who do have symptoms.
OK, well, that's useful for a lot of people then. Now, moving on to Maria, and she's bringing it back to, a discussion that we've just had about your leadership. And she said that you want to replicate the win that you had in St Albans all across the country. Tactical voting let the Liberals down in December, though. So realistically, the best way to get Conservatives out of power, which is, the Liberals' goal, and to see the Liberals in power again, is a deal with Labour. Is this something that you will do?
Well, Liberal Democrats are in second place to the Conservatives in around 82 seats around the country. And that means that we need to focus our efforts on trying to win as many of those as possible. I think at this stage it's too early and probably not very helpful to be talking about deals, but I think we need to see where we are in the run up to the next general election, see what the fault lines are, see what electoral prospects are looking like. But quite frankly, my priority is to try and replace this Conservative government, which is now so far to the right, it's unrecognisable for anybody who would normally call themselves a Conservative. So that's my priority, but what I'm going to do is try and replicate what we did here in St Albans in lots of other seats, and let's see where we are a little bit down the line. The seats that we're targeting are very different seats to the ones that I think Labour will be wanting to win back from the Conservatives.
Does that mean as well that there's no chance of a deal with you and the Conservatives as well?
I think there's almost zero chance. In fact, I'm prepared to say there is zero chance of a deal with this Conservative government. You know, anybody who was a sort of one nation Tory, and by that, and what I mean is somebody who's an internationalist, who respects human rights and the rule of law, but might believe in a much smaller state, for example, and still wants to see action on protecting civil liberties and protecting the environment. Those kinds of people who share those values, who might have voted Conservative in the past, this Conservative Party under Boris Johnson is completely unrecognisable. And the vast majority of Conservative MPs who did have those one nation values have either left, they either left the Conservative Party, or they lost their seats and stood down, or they'd be promoted into the House of Lords because they didn't want to be an MP anymore. So the Conservative Party as it is at the moment doesn't have any of those values. It is extremely right wing, and I'm prepared to say that we won't do a deal with them.
Now, you talk about unrecognisability there, and Kevin has actually messaged us in about a Guardian article which actually explains that maybe the cities around England may be changing. So the article in question is saying that the age of the office is over. Kevin has asked, is this a good thing for constituents in St Albans and Hertfordshire as a whole?
I think when there's any change, there are winners and losers. And I think it's really important for those of us who are elected representatives to make sure we're honest about that, B, we recognise it, and C, we do something about it. So there's no doubt that because of the pandemic and probably because of Brexit as well, a lot of our local businesses have been struggling for some time and will continue to struggle. And therefore, making St Albans a very appealing place to live and having more people here who can boost our local economy in some respects is a really good thing and can be really positive to make sure that we are a thriving community that can sustain our local businesses. On the other hand, when you have an influx of people, if it's bigger than the regular influx, because we do always have an influx here in St Albans, it can drive up house prices and make it even more unaffordable for people to either stay here, particularly for young people when they're leaving home. And what we need to do is make sure that we have the right intervention so that that doesn't happen. And one of the things that obviously the council is trying to do is to build more social homes, which are homes that are truly affordable, with rents that actually match local incomes. So I think if you just allow change to happen without any intervention, it's good for some and bad for others. But hopefully we can work together through various changes, either in Parliament and here locally, to make sure that we make sure that local people still have places to live and can work here and live here and enjoy living here and take part in our community.
Now, another change that might be coming in place, which Sarah has mentioned, she said it was reported that laws may be brought in to regulate social media. How is this possible, though, without potentially inhibiting freedom of speech?
Okay, so freedom of speech is not about giving somebody a carte blanche to say whatever they want. There are already restrictions on freedom of speech in law. So libel, for example, you can't libel somebody. Hate speech is illegal in law. So you can't, pick on particular minority individuals or minority groups and say particular things about them. So there are already restrictions on free speech. And those exist in law, but they also exist in regulation. So there are regulations that cover broadcasters, for example, about the things they can and can't say. Those regulations do not exist for social media. And therefore, a lot of the things that are illegal for other, say, news corporations or for broadcasters to do and say, you can get away with them on social media. So it's entirely possible to protect free speech whilst also bringing in regulations.
So what you're explaining there, Daisy, is actually that these aren't new laws, but it would just be a continuation of the regulation of media from current laws that are already in place, but for other forms of other media.
So to some degree, yes, but obviously there would need to be some different laws and regulations, because social media operates very differently from other parts of the media. So with news corporations and with broadcasters, you have institutions that generate the content and then they kind of broadcast it out, and then individuals can complain to that individual because it's clear who's publishing it. What's very different on social media is that you have content that's generated by users, so lots of ordinary people, who then share that information with other users. So there needs to be a different type of regulation in addition to what might exist elsewhere. So there's a debate at the moment about how you regulate, what you regulate, who you regulate. There's a big question around all of that, but it is possible to provide a form of regulation and certain standards without sort of shutting things down, as it were.
Now, moving on to the final question from our community, and Tina has asked, my daughter has just returned to university. Why have students once again been ignored, and why are they being so unfairly blamed for this second wave of COVID outbreak? Can you make any promises to support the young voters who are often so overlooked?
Well, do you know, I think young people and students in particular have had a really, really tough time this year. You know, they've had their education disrupted enormously. They've missed out on, various sort of rites of passage and celebrations around finishing exams and then celebrating together. And obviously going to university will be a very different experience as well, what with all the need for social distancing. So I think young people had a really tough time. And I think it is, as well as the whole sort of mess that surrounded the final decision around A-level results. So they have had a tough time, and I think it's really unfair that young people are being blamed for this second wave. There are instances, there's been lots of talk about how groups of young people have been having house parties and things, particularly here in Hertfordshire, and that is, has contributed towards rising COVID rates. But there are lots of other groups who have been doing similar things as well who haven't been reported on, and I really don't like this sort of divide and conquer within the community. I don't, I think the blame game is really horrible when you're trying to split generations against each other. I think young people in particular have been receiving very mixed messages, have witnessed double standards, and they are struggling themselves with an incredibly disrupted period of their own lives. So what I can do is I can promise to do what I'm doing already, which is to continue to support young people who are contacting me and asking me for their help. And I'll continue to speak up for them and to make sure that they're getting the support that they need as well.
Now, a positive note that I wanted to end on. You've been nominated for the People's Choice Award for Best MP. Now, with this being your first year as MP, the fact that you're not in the Best Newcomer Award, but the Best Overall Round MP, does that give you a great sense of pride, appreciation to be selected for such a prestigious award?
Well, I mean, it's always nice to be recognised, isn't it? So I'm not going to say no to that. It is always nice to be recognised. But if I'm honest, this is not the reason why you go into politics. You don't go into politics to be thanked for things all the time. You go into politics because you want to help people and you want to make a difference. As part of this sort of competitive process, I was asked to give two or three examples of, initiatives that I'd been involved with or would help to get off the ground here in St Albans. One of the things that I can never talk about is the confidential things that I do to help individual people with their individual concerns. And that's something that I'm probably very proud of as well. So yes, of course, it's lovely to be recognised. And if I was to win it, then that's great. But if I don't, I mean, quite frankly, as I say, it's not the reason you go into politics. So I'll just shrug my shoulders and carry on with the job.
I mean, would you say then that maybe the cat coaster that you won this month, was that an equally prestigious award?
So that wasn't actually, I didn't actually win that. That was part of a campaign by Cats Protection to try and get the attention of MPs, I think. And given that I am a cat lover and I've got three cats, I'm quite pleased with my little cat coaster that I keep next to my laptop.
Well, a huge thank you for your time once again, Daisy. And you'll be back again next month to field people's questions. But for now, as always, it has been so useful to answer the people's questions.